Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
The United States Supreme Court will soon decide whether everyone who lives in America will be asked if she or he is a citizen. The issue relates to the census, that is, the survey that residents are required to fill out every 10 years. The next census comes in 2020. Lawyers for President Donald Trump's government argue that officials need to use the census to find out how many people living in the U.S. are legal citizens. That way, they say, they can better protect citizens' ability to vote in elections. Lawyers opposed to the idea say non-citizens will not answer the survey because they are afraid of being removed from the country. As a result, they say, the information gathered will be incorrect. Census information is required by the Constitution to show how many people live in the country and where. The numbers are used to decide how many lawmakers an area can send to Congress and how much influence a state can have in a presidential election. The information also influences the amount of federal money different areas receive for schools, roads, and other services. So, if non-citizens do not answer the census, areas with high immigrant populations, such as Florida, California, and Texas, could lose political power and money. The current chief of the U.S. Census Bureau is Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. He says he does not have good evidence that that will happen. But he says, even if it did, the benefits of asking about citizenship outweigh the risks. Six of the Census Bureau's former directors have publicly disagreed with him. Judges in three states have also struck down Ross's request. They said it violates the process for adding new census questions, and it may harm the government's ability to carry out the census. Critics have also questioned Ross's political reasons for proposing the question. The Supreme Court is now considering Ross's argument and case. Supporters point out that some form of a citizenship question was included in the census every 10 years between 1890 and 1950. But then, several things happened. One was that the number of immigrants to the U.S. dropped. Margot Anderson, a census historian, told NBC News that the U.S. government passed a measure in 1924 restricting immigration. She said that, as a result, by the mid-1900s, lawmakers were not very concerned about a citizenship question. In addition, she said, survey methods changed. Officials found they could get better information and spend less money by creating two surveys. One survey was long and asked a number of questions, including about citizenship. The other was short and asked only a few questions, none about citizenship. From 1970 to 2000, between 5 and 20% of residents received the long-form survey. Officials used their answers to make informed judgments about the whole country. They found that following a change to immigration laws in 1965, the percentage of foreign-born people in the country grew sharply. In 1970, about 5% of residents were born in another country. In 2000, nearly 11% were. In the early 2000s, survey methods changed again. The Census Bureau began sending about 1 in 38 households a survey every year. It is called the American Community Survey. It is the government's way to collect citizenship information, among other things. Yet, Census Bureau Chief Wilbur Ross says some people do not give honest answers to the questions in the survey. He wants to move the citizenship question from the American Community Survey to the census. If the Supreme Court justices approve, the 2020 census will ask of every U.S. resident, is this person a citizen of the United States? The Supreme Court is likely to announce its decision on the case in June. I'm Katie Weaver.
Do you have a minute? Because I want to tell you something about yes-no questions. As you may know, a yes-no question is a question in which the expected answer is either yes or no. I just used one such question when I asked, "Do you have a minute?" But in the real world, native English speakers might not always form questions fully when they speak to you. Instead, they might say something like, "You have a minute?" Or even, "Got a minute?" Short questions like these are common in informal situations, especially in spoken English. For example, "Got a minute" has been used as a name for website columns and radio shows on issues from health to career choices to saving money. In addition, "Got a minute" was the name of a word game in the 1970s. We see and hear shortened questions everywhere, such as in music, movies, and advertisements. A well-known example is the "Got Milk" advertising campaign, which was launched in the 1990s and ran for 20 years. In the ad, famous actors, fashion models, and musicians promoted the drinking of milk. Today, I will show you how to shorten yes-no questions. Ready? Good, because you just heard another example. And it was probably easy to guess the meaning is, "Are you ready?" On an earlier program, we talked about how to form standard yes-no questions. Knowing this first will help you understand how to shorten them. So here's a quick refresher. We form most yes-no questions this way. auxiliary verb plus subject plus main verb. For example, do you have a minute? Here, the word do is the auxiliary verb followed by the subject you and the main verb have. Auxiliary verbs are often called helping verbs. We use them with main verbs to do things like help form questions and verb tenses. Most standard yes-no questions begin with do, be, or have, but in other yes-no questions, be is the main verb and there is no auxiliary. We form them like this, be plus subject. For example, are you ready? Here, be is the main verb followed by the subject you. When we shorten yes-no questions, we usually do it in one of two ways. Drop the auxiliary or be, or drop the auxiliary or be and the subject. Let's first talk about dropping the auxiliary verb. In informal situations, it is often unnecessary to use the auxiliary verbs do, be, or have at the start of yes-no questions. Listen to this example.
We've been walking for an hour.
Oh, you're getting tired?
Yes, and my feet hurt.
Here, the auxiliary be was dropped from the start of the question, you getting tired? The standard question would be, are you getting tired? Here is another example.
The internet is not working.
The cable company call yet? A crew is supposed to be here by 3 this afternoon.
No, I haven't heard the phone.
Here, the auxiliary do was dropped from the start of the question, the cable company call yet? The standard question would be, did the cable company call yet? We can make even shorter yes-no questions by dropping both the auxiliary verb and the subject. However, we can only drop the subject when the subject is you. Listen to another version of an earlier conversation, this time without the auxiliary verb or subject you.
We've been walking for an hour.
Oh, getting tired?
Yes, and my feet hurt.
Let me now return to something I talked about at the start of the program. You remember the questions got milk and got a minute. They both start yes-no questions with the word got. Such questions come from this standard form. Do plus you plus have. To shorten questions that begin with the words do you have, we often drop the auxiliary verb do and the subject you. But we take a third step. We change the main verb have to got. So you get questions like, got a pen? Got the time? And the ones you heard earlier, got a minute? Got milk? Okay, let's now move to the verb be. Earlier, I told you that sometimes be in yes-no questions acts as the main verb, not an auxiliary. In questions where the main verb is be and it is present tense, we can often drop the be verb. In this next exchange, the main verb be has been dropped from the question.
My presentation is tomorrow.
You nervous?
No, I feel great.
Again, the main verb be was dropped. The standard question would be, are you nervous? And finally, we will look at the shortest possible form, one-word yes-no questions. We usually make them from a specific three-word structure, are plus you plus adjective. Two examples are the questions, are you ready? And Are you nervous? To shorten questions like these, we drop be and the subject you. Here's the last exchange again, this time with both be and the subject you dropped.
My presentation is tomorrow.
Nervous?
No, I feel great.
By now, you might be wondering, what if the yes-no question begins with another auxiliary verb, like will or would, or a modal auxiliary, like should or might? These verbs express tenses or meanings that are lost when they are removed. So avoid shortening such questions. Well, it looks like I needed more than a minute of your time. Got another minute? If so, try the practice on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions during the 1920s. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France because many American citizens had families in those countries. But fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws, and millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long unprotected border with Canada, or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor, and shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books, The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man, in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Bryan remained popular among many traditional Americans. Bryan told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil, because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. He accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Brian and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech. And they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Brian and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Brian himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Brian question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Brian know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Brian answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. It was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II, but neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, of change, and of struggle between the old and new values.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.